Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You know the saying, as American as apple pie. It's interesting, because apples are not even indigenous to these shores. But long before pie came along, there was cider. We're going to learn all about it today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And indeed, fall is in the air, and you look around the markets, we've got pumpkins, we have gourds, and we have apples. Apples, 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 but not nearly as many apple varieties as we once had. I'm going to learn all about apples, varieties, and something that has had a bit of a renaissance, and we hope it grows even more, and that's apple cider. Joining me today is apple evangelist, as he calls himself, Ben Watson. Ben is a senior editor at Chelsea Green Publishing, and he is a food and apple activist and a consultant. Ben is the author of a terrific book that actually is about 10 years old, I guess, now. But he's into a second edition and then with some additions to it called Cider, Hard and Sweet. And Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Linda. It's great to be with you.
Well, you know, I said apple pie, you know, as American as apple pie, and people associate apples and America as being, you know, altogether. There is some history that goes there with apple, with cider barrels, I suppose. But apples are not indigenous to America, and in fact, apple cider has a history much longer than, well, than pre-recorded history, right?
Yeah, and even apple pie isn't really an American innovation. That's something you should say as English as apple
pie. That's right.
The English really developed, you know, perfected the apple pies and the culinary apple varieties that were the best for that. But yeah, you're right. Cider has a very long history, probably dates back at least a couple of thousand years to about the time of the modern era, and it's thought that cider probably originated, you know, the kind of cider making that we would recognize now, probably originated in northern Spain, which is still one of the lesser known but getting to be better known cider regions of the world.
And that, I mean, in the Roman Empire, that would have been in the Roman Empire, because it was Roman times they had a cider, or there was some reference to cider.
There was. They called a lot of the stuff that they made pomorum, which is fairly indistinct, so it could have been made from apples, or they also made perry, what we would call perry, which from pears. So, yeah, they had experience with it, but it really was only when they started to go into northern parts of Europe where apples grew very well, and they introduced a lot of apple varieties to certain places like Britain, that cider making really took off.
Well, it was interesting to read in your book that, because I was curious about cider and where the word came from, and we see the Roman word pomorum and pom being apple, but you mentioned the possibility of cider coming from a Greek word.
It's sakera is actually sakera is actually the Basque word for cider, interesting enough. But that's also the Greek word too. But it could have been. If you want to trace the etymology all the way back, it could even be a Hebrew word called shekar, which just means strong drink, and it's sort of again like the Roman word, kind of undifferentiated.
Well, in Europe, cider was really the beverage. I mean, ales weren't even brewing any ales, right? Is that take us through a little bit?
I mean, again,
that.
cider has sort of a split personality, and always has, and in this country, it's nothing new. This has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. People really have never quite known how to characterize it. It's made from apples, but it's not brewed. It's fermented like a wine, and yet it's not really a wine because it's not made from grapes. So how do you characterize it? And people have always had that sort of a split personality there with it, even in France. But there are certain areas where apples grow extremely well, and certain regions like the West Country of England and Brittany and Normandy and France, and as I said, northern Spain, the Basque region of northern Spain, that really have such a wonderful climate for growing fruit that they... It was always a local and a regional favorite, but in terms of national acceptability, it's only been in those years when war or some sort of natural problem like phylloxera, the louse that destroyed the French wine industry for several years in the 19th century, then you'd see the rise of cider in popularity all over France, and it greatly increased. But it's always been sort of a secondary beverage to those to beers and wines.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and of course, it is lower in alcohol content than beer, but in wine, right?
Yeah, I mean, typically apples it's a function of the fact of how much sugar is in apples, and generally it runs about half as much sugar in the fruit as there is in dead ripe wine grapes. So, you know, whereas you might have a 14% or higher wine, you might have a 6 or 7% cider naturally. Uh-huh. You know, again, without adding any sugar to the cider to up the alcohol level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned apples. Everyone thinks there are so many varieties of apples now because there's been a lot of work on, and you've have been part of that, on bringing back some heirloom and heritage varieties of apples. But I was interested to note that, and it was from your book that you mentioned, in Normandy, in France, around the 1500s, there were 82 varieties of cider apples. That is astounding, especially where we are today. There was a lot of cider being made.
I mean, and also, it's a fairly, like most of these questions, it's a fairly complicated thing to explain briefly, but I mean, a lot of people made cider and still, to some extent, do make cider from whatever they have available. Now, a lot of culinary varieties, some of which are pretty good for making a base of cider and some not. But in this country, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, it really was a grand agricultural experiment. I mean, farmers would save the pumice or the what was left over from pressing cider in the fall, and they would plant it in their fields, and they would select promising, healthy-looking trees that came up and sample the fruits after several years and would grow them out. And if they happened to be a good variety, that's how a lot of our popular even table varieties got established. But in terms of making cider, almost any apple makes decent cider, because once you press it, you know it just has qualities to it. You have to taste it. Is it sour? Is it going to add astringency or bitterness to it, which helps add body, just like wine grapes add body to wine, but they wouldn't be something you'd want to put on your dinner table. The traditional European varieties and some of the wild or seedling varieties of apples in this country that were developed have that kind of an edge to them that make them not good for eating, but absolutely great for fermenting into a wonderful beverage.
Right. Well, and I obviously our listeners got the picture, but when we mention cider today, especially, we're talking about hard cider, even though you do in your book you do talk about sweet cider and the pressing of apples for regular sweet cider. But hard cider is really what we're talking about through history, because the cider was all fermented that we know of, right?
Well, there was no real way to store.
No refrigeration.
Unless you froze it.
Right,
no
refrigeration.
Way to store sweet cider. So
right.
This was a method of preservation, really, in addition to being a nice easy to make alcoholic beverage, it was also, you know, storing the harvest.
Right. Well, cider became, I mean, so popular in Europe that it became a means of exchange, a commodity, if you will. And that carried over to once cider hit these shores. Well, and let's talk about when the apple comes to America. I mean, obviously there were no apples in this country, but when the settlers came, they...
Well, there were no what we would call domesticated apples.
Okay.
I mean, the common apple wasn't in America, but there are three or four species of, at least, of crab apples that we'd call them, or non-common apple species that are indigenous to America. I mean, apples are indigenous to a lot of places in the world, but the kind of apples that have been developed, that are eating varieties or the select varieties, you're right, they weren't available in America. And they really didn't come over. They came over often as seeds because seeds were easier to transport, obviously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Johnny Appleseed was called that for a reason because he didn't actually believe in grafting apple trees. He thought that was, he was a Swedenborgian, religious person, and he believed that it was against God's will to graft because it's a kind of cloning. It's vegetative cloning. You're carrying on that particular variety. But that is the only way, really, for most apples that you can propagate them, what we call true to type. I mean, if you plant a seed of an apple, it's going to be cross-pollinated in all likelihood by a bunch of different other wild apples or different apple varieties, and you're not going to get anything that resembles the parent tree that you're planting it from. You're going to get something that might be wonderful, but there's a very small chance of that. It might be something, and that's one reason that people made so much cider, because they had a whole bunch of seedling apple trees around that really didn't amount to much in terms of using them for other uses.
So they made it into cider. And how long does it take for a seedling to produce fruit?
It varies a lot. It varies based on the genetics of the varieties, but it could be, might be six for a standard-sized apple tree. They might start producing in maybe 6 years, as little as 5 or 6 years, or it could be twice that long. There are some varieties, like Northern Spy is a famous American cider, not just cider apple, but eating apple, and mm-hmm. pie apple, the great pie apple. Mm-hmm. That really takes really 10 years to start producing from a tree. It's not at all precocious.
I asked the question because I was curious if the cultivated apples weren't planted until, let's say, the early 17th century. By the mid 18th century, the figures are like 1 in 10 farms had their own cider mills, so they were producing a lot of apples.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean as I say, it came over in seeds. There were some people who were more wealthy who brought over trees in the fullness of time from Holland and France and England. And one of the famous nurseries was actually on what's now Long Island, and probably in Queens, the Prince Nurseries. And, he's a Huguenot, planter and came over to America and established a wonderful fruit tree nursery there. Washington bought trees from George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and a lot of our founders. That was a secondary thing. The first people would have brought over some trees or branches to graft onto existing native apple trees. That happened down in Virginia, and it also happened up in New York, where Governor Peter Stuyvesant actually had a farm in what's now the Bowery, and one of his apple trees that was planted in the 1600s stood there for about 200 years until it was knocked over after the Civil War.
Why do you think, cider making was so popular? Obviously, it was an inexpensive way to get a beverage. And that's interesting. They needed a beverage, and they drank a lot of cider. So talk a little bit about that. Cider flourished.
A lot of the settlers were obviously from the British Isles to begin with, and they had an ale drinking tradition. But that required, especially if you were living in New England at that time, which was a colder climate during those years, you could grow hops fairly well, and people are starting to grow hops up here again, up in Vermont and New Hampshire and New York State. But at that time, you couldn't really grow barley that well because the climate was not suitable for it. It was too cold. So obviously, I mean, that being the major component of good ale, it was difficult for them to do that. So apples offered another way to have that kind of, to create a beverage that was plentiful and easy to produce. And it also had something to do with the rhythm of the seasons, too, because obviously most apples produce in the late summer, early fall, when there's less intense farm work that goes on. And people just literally, had more time to deal with them then. They could store the apples for a while and press them when they weren't so busy with everything else.
Interesting. Well, as with some of the early production of ales and whiskeys even, same with cider, it was drunk not only as it means that people like to drink it because they could, get a little drunk too. That was fun. It tasted great, but also the water was not potable in many areas, many settlements.
Yeah, people didn't trust the water. I mean, there were so many farmers, and people were virtually all farmers at that time, but they didn't have very sophisticated ideas of keeping their cattle out of streams, or even in some cases, a lot of people thought that manure was just waste and they would take them off and dump it in the stream. So you never really knew what you were getting downstream of a farm. And so they either didn't like that or they didn't like the taste of the water. Sometimes they were very healthy mineral waters, but people just weren't fond of the taste of it. Mm-hmm. Your only other choice was, if you had cows or other animals, was milk, that they really trusted, as something that they could drink every day. It did offer another option.
All right. I mentioned earlier that there was some American patriotism associated with a cider barrel, and that came around election times, where the cider barrel was sort of signified all that was good in America, or being very American, actually being anti-immigrant also.
Right, exactly. It was what's good and bad about about America, even at that time. And it's kind of interesting to look back almost 200 years now, because that was the hard-fought election of 1820, I believe, with William Henry Harrison and James Buchanan. And Harrison's platform was sort of the cider barrel was one of the symbols, of his campaign. It's like, well, it's a great old English tradition sort of thing. So it was, again, yeah, it was a nativist sort of an image back then. So it's interesting that it was used in that way.
Hmm. We're later in the show, we'll talk about types of apples and types of cider. But so we saw this, but right now, kind of covering the whole, history timeline, we had this terrific flourishing of apple cider business. And how much did the Industrial Revolution and technology play in that?
Well, it actually, for a long time, it was one of the causes of probably, or one of the not proximate causes, but maybe subsidiary causes of cider declining, because, why cider declined after the Civil War really was pretty easy to see. People moved off the farms and into cities as a result of industrialization, and that's where the jobs were. So there was a far lower rural population, and at the same time, we had immigration from Northern Europe, or Central Europe, Germany and Scandinavia, and from Southern Europe, places like Italy. And so again, you have the beer and wine dichotomy there. You have the Germans and Scandinavians preferring ales and beers, and in fact, in the German case, lager instead of ale. And you have Italians or Spanish immigrants or people from farther south preferring wines, because wine grapes grew better down there. So when they came over to this country, as the urbanization happened, that really allowed for breweries to spring up in the cities, and that sort of flourished, and then starting in the 19th century. So that was a part of the decline. And then, quite frankly, there was it sort of got painted, even though, as you say, it's half the strength of wine, and is a very healthful and temperate beverage. It was sort of painted with the same brush by the people who started the temperance movement, sort of pre-Prohibition. And farmers actually went out, if they were sympathetic with the temperance people, they would go out and sometimes chop down their orchards of apple trees and get rid of them.
Rather drastic methods, but
it also suffered from the same things that happened in England, which is as people moved to the cities, they would make industrial ciders, and they'd make ciders that would travel better because it's a fairly light beverage. It doesn't last for as long as wine or spirits or something. So they would sometimes, adulterate it by adding rum to it and to increase the strength and make it more fortified, or they would add, ingredients that weren't very good ingredients to it to sort of stretch the apples. And so that gave cider kind of a bad reputation as well.
Hmm. Well, we are now beginning to see a little movement into the area of distillation. And we're going to talk a little bit about that when we come back from a break. And Ben, I want you to tell us later on about the types of apples and types of ciders. So when we come back from the break, we'll hear more.
All of us at Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Hi, we are back on A Taste of the Past talking about cider. And I have on the line Sarah Grady from Glenwood. Glenwood is an agricultural, nonprofit agricultural organization. And Sarah is the Director of Special Projects. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thanks.
Sarah, there is a project going on at Glenwood called the Apple Project. Can you, because I was talking with Ben Watson, and I just mentioned we're talking about ciders, but now there's been a movement into spirits with apple and distilling the cider. Can you talk a little bit about that? About the Apple Project?
Sure. Yeah. So the mission of the Apple Project is to increase the viability of orchards in the Hudson Valley by encouraging the production of hard cider and apple spirits. So the mission of our organization has to do with strengthening the regional food system in the Hudson Valley and helping farms to be more viable in this region where it can be very challenging to operate a farm. And, we've seen this opportunity because the Hudson Valley is a historic apple region in a leading apple state. We've seen this opportunity for the growth of popularity in hard cider and apple spirits to contribute to the viability of orchards. So that's our mission. And we've been doing a number of different things, working directly with producers in this region, both producers of hard cider and apple spirits, and then also trying to build the market and build market awareness for these projects. So, for example, the Cider Week initiative is part of that. There has been, just as we've seen, this growth of popularity with craft beer and New York wine, I see this surge in interest in hard cider, and right alongside with that is, craft distilling and micro-distilled spirits. And there is a really important connection between hard cider and apple spirits in that the cideries and the distilleries are looking for the specialized apples that are really well-suited to these products. So there's a lot that the cider makers and the apple spirits distillers have in common in that regard. But as far as apple spirits go, from our perspective, it's a really excellent, high-value product that, again, will help orchards to see more profits from both producing those products and also selling apples for those those products. So I'd be happy to tell you about a couple of examples in the Hudson Valley, if you like.
Actually, we've got to move on here. What I wanted you to do is let people know, that you're working in conjunction with Colette Rossant and learning from some of the makers in Normandy in France as well.
Yeah, that's right. So last year we programmed an exchange between cider makers and distillers and apple growers in the Hudson Valley with producers of cider and Calvados from a region, a southeastern part of Normandy called La Perche. And Colette Rossant, who is a very well-known food writer, helped us to make this connection between a group of producers here in our region with a group of producers there in La Perche. And the delegation from the Hudson Valley traveled to La Perche last fall, and we visited a number of different cideries and Calvados producers. And the way they produce Calvados there is actually very different from the way that apple spirits are produced here, but there was still a tremendous amount to learn and to be inspired by.
Well, production costs have traditionally been kept low with cider, but obviously running a distillery and distilling the spirits will, you know, is going to be a little bit more costly. Do you think the producers are prepared for that?
Well, we do have a few established distilleries in the Hudson Valley who have already made that capital investment to establish, a still and an operation to create apple spirits. But I will say, you know, in terms of the exchange, one of the things that we saw there that was very inspiring and I hope will influence the way that the products are produced here in the Hudson Valley is that the Calvados producers in this region, in Normandy, don't each have their own still. Actually, what they do is they create their fermented cider at their operation, and then they share in the operation of a mobile still. And that mobile still comes around and distills the portion of their fermented cider that they want to transform into Calvados.
Oh, interesting.
And then even beyond, so there's already this level of cooperation, but even beyond that, in terms of the aging and the marketing of their finer Calvados, there is also a cooperative that pools their distilled young apple brandy and ages it together in a cooperative aging cave. And that is actually how they have banded together to produce these 25, 5, 10, 15, 25-year-old Calvados.
That's interesting. It's certainly a project to watch, and those in the New York area can learn a lot more at the New York Cider Fest, and that's the week of October 12th, and you can find more information at ciderweekny.com. Sarah, thank you very much. And one thing that Sarah did say, that as far as something that she has written about, and that is that cider and these spirits will grow, and especially the Hudson Valley sitting on a gold mine, and demand is the one thing that will ensure success. So we look forward to seeing more about these projects. And now back to our discussion on cider per se. I have a couple questions for you, Ben, and that is to describe cider. A lot of people, when they think of cider, hard cider, well, obviously sweet cider is what it is. But when they think of hard cider, they think, oh, we're just going to have an alcoholic, sweet, gooey beverage. Can you describe really the tastes and some of the differences of ciders as we know?
Sure. I mean, the familiar product and the thing that's driving a lot of the growth in the market right now, which is good in the sense that people are discovering it, but it's what we call draft cider. The French call it cidre industriel, industrial cider, which is a little less complimentary. But it's made sometimes by operations that are owned by breweries, but in other ways, it is made in large volumes. It has to be stabilized to some extent. It's made year round. It has to be shelf stable. It's a very different product from what I call real cider, although I mean it is real cider, but it's a very different product from what you'd find at a farmstead operation or a small producer making this, which it's much more as you pointed out, often sweeter, It's just a different taste experience, and you know they're experimenting with different things, and I think that the larger producers will come out with lines of different taste profiles in time.
So. Well, now does cider when it's you have to explain the process to me? It's fermented. It's a process of fermentation, but then some of it's sparkling and some of it's still.
Yeah, and the sparkling is sometimes can be done naturally. You can do a dosage of some form of sugar in the bottle, or you can. Some people have even bottle pasteurized cider after it was bottled to create sort of a naturally sweeter or off dry or semi sweet cider. But often, when you get the sparkling ciders, they're often achieved by just bottling them with a counter pressure filler and adding some carbon dioxide to it, which is, you know, again, it's fine, and it makes for a rather it increases the pleasure often, but you lose a little bit of the taste, in my opinion. You know, if you're really trying to tell the differences of cider varieties or different cider apples that you're using in a blend, I find it often, to my taste, just to have a still cider that is naturally fermented without additional sugar, that's fermented to completion, to dryness, is the best way to tell what an apple will do naturally in a drink. Just like you would with a wine. You know, you wouldn't throw a lot of carbonation into a red wine and then try to say, well, these grapes, these Tannat grapes that I'm using here, obviously they taste like X, because, you know, it helps to mask the taste a little bit.
Does cider age like wine?
Well, it doesn't age. I mean, it doesn't age for decades and decades. That does not improve it. But the conventional wisdom used to be, oh, you have to drink cider in the same year that you make it, or within 2 years. But well-made cider, if it's good quality and is made well and is made in a sanitary way, not a sterile way, but a sanitary conditions, which hopefully everyone is using, and is made from good apples that often have, you know, good Brix or sugar level in them, some of those ciders can improve for 4 or 5 or even longer years, even more years. There are some ciders that even benefit from that if they're especially high acid but otherwise good tasting ciders, but they're too sharp. Sometimes leaving it in the bottle will help condition it, and it might almost be better 4 or 5 years from now than it is today.
Oh, that's great. I mean, that I think that anything that you can build the mystique around cider, around a beverage, I think increases the popularity and people's curiosity, and that certainly we need to introduce more people to cider, or introduce cider to more people, you know, right, however we do it. You mentioned the different having good Brix in the apples, and you also made some comment about the forgotten cider apples. What are the best apples for cider? For a more sophisticated fermentation of cider, something that would not be, you know, that we would be surprised to say, oh, gee, well, I'm drinking apple cider. What are the best apples for that?
Well, it's hard to generalize because, I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, I can give you some examples, but before I say that, I mean, essentially what you're dealing with apples is the same thing you're dealing with wine grapes. I mean, what you're looking for is, it's contributing three things to the cider. Sugar, which is obvious, the level of sugar in the fruit, you know, will be what's fermented, and it creates the alcohol in a fairly direct correspondence. Acidity in the apple, and a little of that is good. Too much is probably, you know, you can throw things out of whack. And then tannins, and those are the things that are found quite often in wild apples or in European type apple varieties, and those are the things that give you that sensation of like sucking on a wet tea bag. You know, it sort of puckers up your mouth, which sounds really not very good. But again, that is the thing that creates structure in a cider, just like it does in wine. And having said that, some of the great, you know, North American apple varieties, forget about the European bittersweets and bitter sharps and things like that, would be something like Golden Russet, which is a New York State apple. It's also an English apple, but there's one, an American golden russet, too. And that typically has a very high Brix level or sugar level in it, and it's a late-ripening variety. Most late-ripening apples are, as a class, superior to earlier-ripening apples. But there are other ones that are being rediscovered now, too. The Harrison is a cider apple that probably originated in New Jersey. We're not quite sure, but probably around 1800. And a friend of mine actually was instrumental in bringing that back to Tom Burford, who's an orchardist from Virginia, was instrumental in discovering a source of Harrison apples that someone had discovered in New Jersey, and sort of bringing that back into the nursery trade. And now cider makers are planting Harrison apple trees, and it makes just a lovely, thick, syrupy kind of a sweet cider that is good for blending, but it also makes spectacular hard cider, too.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it's good to, instead of single, a lot of people make single variety ciders, but I find that almost any apple is improved by adding a few other types of apples that fill in the deficiencies of one particular apple variety. So blends are often, can be quite sophisticated, but it's good to blend different apples together.
Interesting. And just to set people straight, what is the difference between hard cider and applejack?
Hard cider is fermented, and if you take that cider after you've fermented it and you take it outside and you let it freeze in the depths of winter, it will concentrate just like it would in your freezer. If you have sweet cider, it would concentrate the sweetness, and in the case of applejack, it would concentrate the all of the non-water components, including the alcohol, into a very very concentrated sort of a beverage that would be about 15% alcohol, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That's the natural way to make applejack. Most people, when they refer to applejack, they're talking about cider brandy, and that's another commonly used term is applejack, but that's distilled in the regular way, like what Sarah was talking about,
right,
with an alembic still or some kind of a still.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's fascinating to see the growth or the rebirth of cider and the cider industry in this country. I mean, a lot of it unfortunately happened. I mean, it happened from an unfortunate situation, people trying to save the family farms. But the growth and boom of cider makers is wonderful, and I hope that we can keep that going.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be good for the apple, for orchardists too, for regional orchardists, because now this year has not been a good apple year. You and I were talking about that before a couple
right.
of days ago, just because of weather conditions. But the price of apples is much better than it has been, which helps to support small farmers and regional orchardists, and cider apples themselves are something that people are looking into to start growing, because there's more of a demand for using really good cider fruit for making hard cider.
All right. Now, sometimes these apples are not something you would want to pick off the tree and bite into. Is
no, they do have those tannins in the flesh and in the skin that make them bitter. They're English and French and Spanish varieties that are being grown over here that you would not want to eat, and they're really not good for cooking either. So really the only use for them is to make really good cider out of them, or to contribute to a really good cider.
All right. Well, I mentioned the New York Cider Week that's happening in October. You're involved in a festival up your way in November, is that correct?
Yeah, the first weekend in November every year is something called Cider Days. It used to be Cider Day, but it got so popular a few years ago, and we had so many people coming and so much programming that it became a whole weekend of activities. And it takes place in and around the Pioneer Valley in Franklin County in New Hampshire, which is around Greenfield, Mass. So for people in New York and Connecticut and that area. It's an easy drive up the highway to go to it, and it takes place in a number of different orchards and venues and historic buildings, and it's just a fun time. You get to try all sorts of varieties of cider at this cider salon that we do from all over the country and internationally too. We have some international producers and brands that'll be there too.
That's terrific. And there's a
good way to learn about, if you haven't tried hard cider before, it's a good way to learn about, number one, whether you really like it and what kinds of stuff you like.
Right. I think a lot of people need more education in apple cider. I know I myself do, too. Is there a website people can go to find out about the festival?
Yeah, it's just www.ciderdays.org.
Ciderdays.org. Okay. Ben, it's been, you've given me so much information and so many things that I have to go back now and research and read and indeed read the rest of your book called Cider, Hard and Sweet, and it's a history and tradition of cider making. It also gives you instructions for how to make your own cider, right?
Yep, it's incredibly easy to make. It's one of those things that's very hard to perfect, but it's very easy to get started and very inexpensive too.
Well, I'm going to end with a quote from your book, something that you say, and that is, "A good natural cider is deep, dark, and mysterious, like a good pint of stout or a bowl of homemade gumbo. Drinking it refreshes the soul and leaves you wanting more." And I can say that about today's discussion with you, Ben. Leaves me wanting more. I want to learn more about cider, and I hope our listeners do too. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, you're very
welcome.
On
A Taste of the Past.
You're very welcome. Nice to be with you.
You've been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.